So welcome everyone. This thing is working. Good. So welcome everyone. Usually between the end of the walking meditation and before the Dharma talk begins is some sort of a chanting, but we're not going to do that today. That's for a change. Is there anybody who is new today and never been here before? Okay. What I'd like to do with you today, I have some material, but since I haven't been here in over a month, I always like to now and then provide opportunity to answer questions. Questions that people might have about the meditation practice that we do here, about mindfulness in general, or just since everybody reads things, listens to talks on the internet and all that, it's a wide field. There may be some questions that people have just about practice and how you bring these various types of teachings, psychological, behavioral, philosophical, spiritual, whatever you want to call them. You know, how do I bring them into my life? How do I really practice them? These teachings and practices are meant to be lived, which means they're meant to be brought into our daily life so they can be effective. So why don't we begin? Again, whether you've been here before many times or you're new, please feel free to ask any question you may have about practice. Don't be shy. I know everybody here has questions, but everybody's shy. So if you have a question, you just put your hands like that. Yes, Jarna.
Fred, I wanted to tell you thank you for hosting the Dharma Talks from the retreat. Started to listen to it. Last night I heard of something you said, and it caught my attention. And wondered if this was a correct understanding of it.
Okay.
The phrase was, the mind is ensnared in phenomena. I was wondering if that could also be another way of describing attention.
So I'm just going to repeat that so everybody heard it. We recently had a 7-day retreat up at Southern Dharma, up in Hot Springs, up in the mountains north of Asheville. And I believe those talks are now posted on the web. And Charna was listening to them, and she heard a phrase about being, the mind ensnared in phenomena. One of these wonderful Buddhist phrases. And she wondered, what does that mean, and is that about attachment? Yeah. It is one of those, very deep teachings. Sounds very simple. Phenomena, again, and let me just back up a little bit, because Buddhist psychology and these terms have certain meaning different than Western psychology. Phenomena means thing, anything, right? And in Buddhism, the mind is aware of various types of phenomena, right? And it's probably the phenomena of the world is known to us through our six consciousnesses. Okay, so the eyes see objects. So everything the eye sees is a phenomena, right? Okay, like anything you see is a phenomena that's appearing to your eye, right? Anything you hear is a sound. It's a phenomena. A sound phenomena, smell, taste, feel, touch. So the whole way we know the external world and all the things in it is through those five senses. Is that clear? That's how we know the world of phenomena. But as you all know, and in Buddhism, the mind, the thinking mind, the cognizant mind, is also considered a consciousness. And so there's also mental phenomena, thoughts, feelings, memories, perceptions, right? So there's external phenomena and then there's internal phenomena. But if you put it all together, it's what? It's everything. Right? Now, the instruction was do not get ensnared in phenomena. It's like, cuts right, these are very direct teachings. You want to get right to the heart of things. So what you notice is with all these, with our eyes, we endlessly, just move your head around. You can just endlessly see different phenomena, right? You go outside, you'll see. It's endless. Sounds are endless. Smells are endless. Tastes are endless, right? Have you noticed all that? Sensations you feel in your body. They're always just coming and going, right? Endlessly coming and going. Totally impermanent. As well as if you look into your mind and you observe mental phenomena, right? Thoughts, feelings, perceptions, stories, memories. the whole deal. You notice what? Endlessly changing, coming and going, right? So this whole world of phenomena is totally unstable, totally arising and passing, we might say. And the instruction is, don't get ensnared in it. Don't get ensnared in it. Because when we get ensnared in it, we then what? Are stopping this endlessly unfolding, right? Things are just endlessly unfolding. Life is just endlessly unfolding. The moment of 2 minutes ago is already past, right? So to attach, to grab onto any type of phenomena is to stop the unfolding of life. It also is it's sort of a contamination of life. Because life, again, is just endlessly arising and passing, the phenomena. It's endlessly arising and passing. And rather than just understanding that and just being with it and being present to it and dealing with it, we what? We grab on to. We hold on to. We don't want things to change. We want good things to stay. We want bad things to go, right? We mull over, we grab onto objects, things, we buy something, we always want to have it, then it breaks, and we're devastated. Did you see? And we always have to keep the stories going rather than just letting it. So this is a very deep instruction. It says, how do we relate to the phenomena? Don't get ensnared, right? Ensnarement has to do with entrapment. Probably relates to if you think of a free animal that's caught in a trap, that's caught in a snare. Right? Its freedom has now been taken from it, hasn't it? It's caught. And we are constantly ensnaring ourselves because we grab onto phenomena. And phenomena, again, is anything. Objects, physical objects, people, relationships. But for those of us, our probably worst ensnarement is we're ensnared in the world of our own thoughts, our own stories. That we endlessly play over and over and over and over and over again. That's ensnarement. Because we're replaying things what? That have already happened. We're replaying things that haven't happened, that we're afraid is going to happen, or we fantasize is going to happen. And then when we get sick of all that, we do what we what? We find something else to get ensnared in. We have that momentary relief when we feel like, oh, I finally let go of that. Or I finally resolved that issue, now. And then what do? On to the next. We don't even give ourselves much of a break. Right? So that was a very profound text that was taught during that retreat. And it really goes to the heart of things. Do not be ensnared in phenomena. Again, please understand, it doesn't say reject. It doesn't say avoid. It doesn't say that we cannot enjoy the things we see, the things we smell, the things we hear, right? But just, you know, enjoy them when they're alive, when they're happening in the present. We miss so much of our life because we are lost in our thoughts, in our stories, in our obsessions about past and future, and about ourself, and right, how I am. Do you know what I'm talking about? That's all ensnarement. And that text is trying to free us. So it's something to be practiced. Other questions about practice? Yes, in the back. Yes. Yeah, good question. How old is your son?
10.
Good question. So how would we answer a 10-year-old? I would say for you, meditation is something very simple. It's not very complicated. For a 10-year-old, it is much easier to meditate than those of the rest of us who have decades of contamination. Yeah, meditation really is to know things as they really are. I mean, many people think meditation is a technique, right? And many meditations are taught as techniques. But a lot in Buddhism, a lot of those techniques are just preparatory to quiet and still the mind. But at the truest level, meditation is getting to know things as they really are. To know myself as I really am, life as it really is, the mind as it really is. Right. And so it's really just a matter of developing, how can I just be present to whatever is arising right now? Because if I want to know who and what I am, and if I want to know what life is, I just have to be present to it. Right? It's that simple. I have to be present. Now, what's your son's name? What's your name?
Ricardo.
You see, now what gets in the way of us knowing what's going on is that we are what? Thinking. Where we have stories going in our mind all the time. But those stories that are going on in our mind are our own creation. That's not what really is going on in life, right? It's like we have our own little TV show going on all the time, just for us. And the problem with that is not only are we totally always watching our own little TV screen in our mind, and therefore we think that's what's really going on in life, we forget that nobody else can see our TV screen. You see, that's the scary thing. You see, we think it's all our stories about life and ourself and who I was and who I am and what my issues were and what my future will be and how I want people to perceive me. You know, we think that that's real, but nobody else can see it but us. So it only has a reality just for, right, just for Ricardo. And your mom may not, she might have her own TV screen. Right? So the more that Ricardo can just learn just to be simple, right? To see what's in front of him, to deal with whatever he's dealing with right in the present. And he knows that in relationship to his mother, he doesn't have a clue what's going on in her TV screen. The same way she doesn't have a clue about what's going on in Ricardo's. So that is why communication is so important, different. Because one of the things we need to learn is we really, not only do many of us not really know ourselves, but we really don't have a clue about others. Right? So that could be discouraging, or that can be very wonderful. Because it means that all our encounters with other people can be very fresh, and there can be a lot of curiosity and interest, right? Like, to know you doesn't mean I have to judge you. To know you doesn't mean I have to have thoughts or opinions or evaluations or assessments about you or ideas about you. Because that's all being created, what? By me. And that is very skewed, because I'm seeing you through all my stuff. Right? Historical stuff, issue stuff, needs, wants, right? So if I can not have any of that going on, right? And if I can just be present to you, and if I want to know what's really going on with you, I need to what? Ask you, talk with you. And now relationships become much simpler and much more alive, right? They're alive. The same way if somebody gave you a piece of fruit, you wouldn't know that piece of fruit just by keeping it on the table, would you? You would just know it from the outside shape. But to really know a piece of fruit, you have to what? Eat it, chew on it, taste it, right? Then you kind of get the real, more deeper sense of what that fruit really is. It's an experience now. In the same way, if we want to get to know ourselves, we have to be willing to experience ourselves just as we are very directly. This is meditation. If we want to get to know someone else, we have to be willing to enter them in the same openness and presence that we would eating a fruit, looking at a flower. Right? See, there was once a man who said, if you've seen one redwood, you've seen them all. And in a certain way, at a deep level, that has a certain truth to it. But it's also very sad. Because that means if you think if you know one redwood, you know all redwoods, that means when you encounter all the other redwoods, you'll already have an opinion about what they are. And so you'll never know them. Right? So the truth is, to know one redwood is to know just one redwood. And the next redwood also is inviting us to encounter them. We often think people that we know well, we might even live with them, they may be our family, we think we know them. Which often means every encounter we have with them is not fresh. Please, the same way we learn to be fresh in our meditation, we should be fresh in our relationships, which means always new. Right? Always new, as if you've never talked to the person, you know what I'm saying? Then it's alive. So that's meditation. To be alive, to be present, to be open, to have an empty mind. Means an empty mind means a mind that's free of all these judgments and evaluations and seeing situations through the past. And so that's meditation. It's not just crossing your legs and lighting some incense and focusing on your breath. That's just a way of quieting the mind and calming the mind so we can begin to notice you know, the fog can begin to lift a little bit. The murkiness in the water, the sediment can begin to settle so we can clearly see to the bottom. So that's meditation. Other questions about practice? Yes.
I have two friends in a different city, and they've both been practicing meditation for a long time. One of the two has been suffering for several years over several losses in his life, and her friend, who's a very senior practitioner, has been trying to help her in terms of being very kind, warm, present for her, but it doesn't seem to be helping this first person. So could you address Buddhism as palliative versus, you know, what might be the wise way to help you?
So the question is, just generally, somebody is suffering, in this case, suffering from loss. And has a friend who is being very kind and supportive to them, and as time goes on, this person continues to suffer this loss. And your question is, how does that relate to Buddhist teaching? That directly relates to Buddhist teaching. And I think it's very important. You know, those who've been around, you hear me say often, the Buddha said over and over again, I teach one thing, he said, and that is, I teach the cessation of suffering. Okay? Now, we know if you have read Buddhism, studied Buddhism, there are millions of teachings, thousands of teachings. But they're all in the service of this one thing, cessation of suffering. So therefore, whatever practice you're doing, whether you're doing Buddhist, non-Buddhist, whatever practices you're doing, spiritual practice, religious practices in your life, I would say the criteria you would have of whether they are helpful to you is your suffering diminishing? It's not whether you're doing better at the practice. See, a lot of people think that meditative practice is about becoming successful at meditative practices, right? Oh, my meditation is much better these days. I'm able to concentrate much more. My life still sucks, you know, but my practice is going better. All right, do you understand there's a problem there? But it's a very fundamental problem, right? And this is, and again, it is very much, you know, in certain spiritual, the emphasis will be on, you know, practice. And how's your practice going? Oh, my practice is going well. Yes, I've done so much this, and I've done so much that, and I've increased it from a half an hour to an hour, or 3 hours, or 20 hours, or, you know, it's like, as if it's a sport, you see what I'm saying, you know? It's like you'd say to somebody, well, how's your running going? And how's your jogging? Oh, I've worked up, you know, I'm now doing 5 miles a day, and I'm much faster. You see how that mind of ours, and then we take it into the meditative spiritual realm, and we're also turning these things into things to do that we can then get better at. So the Buddha said, I teach one thing, the cessation of suffering. Now, this is important because in Buddhism, there is in the Buddha's teachings about love, he used the word karuna. Karuna means in Buddhism, it's translated often as compassion. But it's very important that we understand that in Buddhist teaching, that karuna, compassion, does not just mean empathy. And I think that's what we're talking about. Empathy, to be an empathic person, means we're what? Someone who feels the suffering of another, right, is open to experiencing, to be present to the suffering of another. That's an empathic person. But in Buddhism, that's not called a compassionate person. Because in the word karuna means that one wants, that one, it combines empathy, but it's an active. So in karuna means I feel I am present to the suffering of another and I want to relieve it. Is that clear? I want to relieve it. This is the key thing. Because as you're saying, you know, empathy by itself has no wisdom, right? Empathy by itself, in the short run, can feel good, right? So if I'm suffering and there's somebody who is sympathetic to me, how do I feel? It's nice to know that somebody else is sympathetic or empathic to my suffering, right? I feel better. And the next day, I mean, you know, and the next day, and the next day, and the next day, and you know, and years go by. And I continue to suffer, but I still have this very nice empathic person, right? So at some point, now again, this is ancient Buddhism, but this is also what we call in the West now, in America now, we call that what? Enabling, right? Enabling means that there is some behavior that is actually a behavior that causes suffering that is being enabled by even our seeming what? Good intentions, goodwill. Is that clear? So, while certainly if someone has experienced, in this case, a loss or is grieving, in the short run, we naturally would be empathic, right? We would be supportive, right? But if months and years went on and the person continues to suffer, at a certain point, we need to, a different intervention is needed. Right? Something is wrong. You know, I mean, I guess what comes to me first, without even going too deep, are people familiar with the five remembrances? It's something that we practice, chant every day. Who's not familiar with the five remembrances? Okay, so the five remembrances are basic, kind of basic Buddhist formulation. And it goes like, I am of the nature to get sick. It really comes back to the early experience of the Buddha himself that drove him into his spiritual search. You know, and it's the five remembrances I remember. I and all beings are the nature to get sick. I and all beings are the nature to grow old. I and all beings are the nature to die. And everything and everyone I love is, everything is subject to change. Right? Now, those are not, you can repeat those, right? Like a little formula, but that won't be helpful. What is helpful is to do what the Buddha did, which is to really reflect and meditate deeply on that so we get it. You see, we get it. And when you get it, you know, you'll know you get it because sickness, old age, death, and change and impermanence are no longer causes of suffering to you. You understand what? But this is just the nature of life. I mean, the formulation of these remembrances and reflections are not meant to be downers. They're not meant to be depressing. They're not meant to bum us out. Ooh, please don't talk about such things. Right? Can't we focus on the positive in life? Right? People might talk that way. But, you know, this is the stuff that snares people, sure, right? A lot of people, I mean, sickness is part of life. Is there anybody in here who's never been sick? Never been sick their whole life? Is there anybody who knows that somebody who's never been sick? And this is somebody who's more than, let's say, 6 months old. We laugh because it's because we know what? To have a body is to be is to get sick. It doesn't mean we can't take care of ourselves, try to be healthy, you know, etc. But will we, you know, the body gets sick. Is it, again, aging. Is there anybody here who's never aged? See, it's so ridiculous, isn't it? Because we know, you know, when we are rational for a moment, we know what? Yeah, everybody ages. Everybody, including me. Right? Sickness, old age, death. I mean, is death normal? I mean, this is a big one. Is death normal? Of course it is. Everybody dies. I mean, our lifespan is fairly... Turtles outlive us. Right? I mean... You know, our lifespan in the bigger picture of things is fairly short, right? An average lifespan in America is now, what, 77, 78? I mean, in the, you know... In the greater scheme of things, that's a blip, isn't it? And the teaching says, you know, death is a known. Everybody will die. What is unknown is when it's going to happen. Right? That's the only unknown. The problem is we live in this delusion that somehow it's going to happen somewhere, you know, I don't know where, but it's not, right? Not soon. But the truth is, we don't know that either, do we? I mean, generally we say that, you know, people tend to die more when they're older than they're younger, but that's not true. All of us know people who have died when they weren't supposed to. That also happens. That is normal. So, and then that fourth one, which is everything is characterized by impermanence, which means we will be separated. We will be separated from everything we love, whether it's a person, a job, an object, right? That is the truth. And whether they leave us first or we leave them first, that's again unknown. Right? But that's just the way it is. It doesn't have to be depressing. It doesn't have to be a bummer. It can actually be something that wakes us up. Wow. Life is very precious. This moment is very precious. This is really all I have. You know? And in this world of sickness, old age, and death, and impermanence, you know, the reason we practice Dharma, the reason we practice this way is so we can learn to live in the midst of this impermanence happily, peacefully, joyously, wisely, intelligently, right? But within reality. We don't need to create an alternate reality where there's no sickness, there's no aging, there's no death, there's no impermanence, right? That's what we try to do. We get ensnared and we cling and we attach. And we just cause more suffering for ourselves. Because many people, when they're not happy, when they perceive themselves aging, it's a source of suffering to them. And that's abnormal. That's a suffering that we create ourselves. Aging is normal. Sickness is normal. Death is normal. But then again, it's normal for everyone else. But we're always shocked when it happens to us or those we love. Big right? So many of us will go, oh yeah, I understand all that. Right? We are so intelligent up here. Oh, I understand. Yeah, everything's impermanent. I understand. I know death, sickness, and old age, right? It just shouldn't happen to me or anybody I love. Right? Then I get a little freaked out. I mean, I, you know, I can read the paper every day. 10,000 children die of malnutrition, wars, disease. You know, I can read about it every day, right? That's all we hear about. All over the world. but not when it happens to me or those I love, it shouldn't happen. But can you see how distorted that is? Because it is going to happen. And if it doesn't, there's some good fortune for a time. But we don't know, do we? So again, this is not even meditation. This is like basic Buddhism, the five remembrances. Very powerful, right? Very powerful. Again, grief and loss is a normal part of life. It is also normal in the short run to feel sadness, to feel the loss. That's normal. A delusion is some sort of belief that is not true, right? And again, in the mental health field, people are labeled with delusive disorder, right? They believe something about themselves or life that is patently untrue, right? But they believe it's true. So we say this person has a delusion. Jodie Foster's in love with me. Could possibly be true, but probably if I keep repeating this to everybody I know, they would begin to say, I think Fred has a delusion. He's believing something that is not true. We have many delusions. Many of them are small, some of them are big. And we want to about the big things to get it straight. So reflect deeply on change and impermanence, especially how it relates to us as human beings, which means us as individuals, the people we love, friends, family, everyone is subject to change. Change for human means that we are born, we grow, we begin to degenerate, and eventually we die. That's the normal pattern. But we know because of accidents and disease, it can happen in different ways. Because this life is very fragile. Right? It doesn't take much to take our way of life, as we know. Right? So this life is very fragile, this life is very precious, and reflecting on the way, again, is not to get you depressed. It's not morbid. It's to kind of wake us up so we can really appreciate what we have. I am alive right now. I have eyes that see, ears that hear, nose that smell, mouth that taste. I have emotions, I have feel, I'm alive. Let me be present to life. Because I do not know. Why do I not know? Because of sickness, old age, and death, and impermanence. What's going to be tomorrow, right? So these teachings are meant to wake us up, to free us. Yeah, so there was one more thing in that, and that's very important. Palliative care, you use the word palliative. Palliative care is good, right? They do a lot of palliative care with people in hospice who are dying, right? It's like they're dying. I want to make them comfortable. Right, take care of their pain. Palliative care. But in terms of Buddhism and Dharma, it shouldn't be palliative care. We shouldn't be practicing Dharma just to ease, the pain a little bit. We should be practicing to liberate ourselves from pain, from this kind of suffering, the self-created suffering. And that's important. That's what I said. The Buddha said cessation of suffering. It's a pretty bold statement, isn't it? Those of you who have read a little bit about Buddhism, the Four Noble Truths, right? Dukkha, cause of dukkha, end of dukkha. End of dukkha, nirodha, nirvana, nirodha, means cessation of suffering. That's what Buddha said. That's it. There is all kinds of suffering that the human being experiences. Most of it is self-created by their own wrong beliefs and thoughts and actions and all that. But when you understand what's causing the suffering, you can free yourself from that suffering. Cessation of suffering. And then the fourth is the path. This is how you go about doing it. So it's very simple. Very, very simple. The problem is what? What? Yeah, the problem is we are bad patients. We don't like to follow the prescription, do we? We like to do it our way. Because we're so smart. Of course, if we're so smart, how do we get ourselves to where we are? So, yeah. So that's the big one. You know. The fourth, a noble truth. Am I willing? Not am I willing. Do I want? Would I like to be free of suffering? And am I willing to follow a path, a way, a prescription that allows me to do it? And that's a very it's a personal question, right? It's something easy to say yes to, but I think it's important that, again, these kinds of things be reflected on deeply. You know, one, do I really see that so much of this drama of my life and the emotions and, you know, do I see that I am really the creator of most of that? And do I understand that it doesn't have to be done that way? And do I understand that if it doesn't have to be done that way and could be done differently, I could feel and experience and relate in a totally dramatically different way? Right? Do I really believe that? You know, and that's called trust and confidence in the path. And that's a process. Since Buddhism is not a faith-based religion, it is a path that is eminently practical and rational and subject to investigation. But at the end of one's investigation, does one have confidence in it? Right? If you don't have confidence in your doctor, right? If you don't trust your doctor, you may not follow what they say. But if you have trust and confidence that he or she knows what they're doing, has good experience, very competent, kind of assess the situation clearly, and is prescribing a mode of treatment that is very effective, right? Then I'll follow it. Because I have trust and confidence, as well as I want to get well. See, I want to get well. If I don't really want to get well, then it's all kind of moot, right? It's all kind of moot. Because I could be going to a good doctor, there's good medicine, good treatment available. But if I really don't want to get well, if for some reason I am stuck in my suffering, stuck in my pattern, don't really think it could be any different, or don't want it to be any different, or don't believe it can be different, don't believe I'm really capable of making that kind of changes or shifts or transformations in my life, you know, the medicine stays on the shelf. The prescriptions are never filled. And after a time, we do what? We go to a new doctor. And we start all over again. And we get worked up, and we get the assessment, and we get prescriptions, and blah, 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 right? And there are many people like that. in the medical world as well as in the spiritual world. I go from one to another. Never take the medicine as prescribed. Yes, any other questions about practice? Yes.
In relation to what you're saying then, to the question, if the individual isn't at that place yet, there and there's a friend that you're providing, you know, helping them with the palliative care.
Sure, yeah.
And they're not willing to accept or open to the, then how, then you just have to accept that that's where they're at, and do you continue, or do you just, that's...
Yeah, so the question is, okay, so let's say you're dealing with somebody who is suffering, and you've been empathic and supportive, and time has gone by, and it's very clear they have a problem that is remediable, has a remedy, right? And, right, and yeah. So it's a personal choice. I mean, enabling means that you really realize that perhaps my kindness, my supportiveness, is really just keeping it going. See, that's the thing I think we need to look at. You know, maybe my intervention is not as benign as I say think it is, but I'm actually supporting it because I'm not talking the truth. I'm not speaking the truth. Why? See, the question I think we need to ask ourselves, why won't I speak the truth to myself or somebody else? I mean, I love them. They're suffering. I don't want them to suffer. Yet I never speak the truth to them. Because why? You need to ask yourself, why? Because if I speak the truth, then what might happen? What might happen, MT?
You're going to have to deal with whatever.
Yeah, they might get what?
They might not like it.
They may not like it. They may not like it. They may get angry at you. They may act out. They may, yeah, that's true. You know. Sometimes the medicine's a little bitter. Yeah, but again, you know, so again, there has to be intelligence. There has to be, you know, I mean, you don't just go around telling everybody what you think of them. You know, I mean, you know, I mean, it's not our job to go around the world straightening everybody else out. All right, so I'm glad you brought that up. So again, you know, we have enough trouble just straightening ourselves out. So that's, I mean, our main focus is, yeah, I got to be, you know, am I willing to hold the mirror up to myself and see myself clearly, my stuff clearly, and am I willing to take the medicine? Okay, so that's the main. Yeah, but again, because we are in relationship to people and we care, you know, we have to just be, I mean, this whole idea of helping is not so easy, as you say, because some things that appear helpful or in a certain circumstance can be helpful, right, in another circumstance could actually be harmful. Yeah, and again, the question is, if you really want to help them be free of their suffering, are you willing to speak the truth to them? Now, again, hopefully, the truth can be spoken in a kind way, in a supportive way, in a loving way. I mean, it's not like cruel, but it's direct. And again, you do it not because, you know, again, this is the important thing. You do it not because you just can't take it anymore. If I got to listen to this person one more moment, I'm just, you know, and all of a sudden we just, you know, one day explode and let them have it. See, that's not the way to do it. It should never be around it, you know. To be compassionate is I want to help the other person. That's the focus. If there's me in it, I can't take this anymore, they're driving me crazy, you know what I mean, or, you know, what's wrong with them, then don't do it. But it's really when you're clear and you can see their suffering and you can see what's causing it and you can see that all this niceness and kindness is not helping, right? And then the intervention has to be skillful. Okay. It may rock the boat a little bit. But the person's already suffering. I mean, you know, maybe the boat needs to be rocked. Right? I mean, what kind of boat is it? It's not a happy boat. What was that TV show or something? What was that about the cruise ship? The Love Boat. Right? I mean, it's not, it's, you know, this person's not on the Love Boat. So again, when you see that they're really unhappy and their life is not working for them and this thing is just eating at them, you know, what's in a certain sense to lose other than they may not be happy with you in the short run? But again, if it's not about you, that's not your consideration. Your consideration is them. I'm willing to have them disappointed or pissed or hurt by at me to deliver the message that I think would be most helpful to them. See, that's when I'm thinking more about them than me. And oftentimes we think we're thinking about them, but we're really thinking about me. And that's not compassion. That's not selfless, is it? No. Good. Other questions about practice? Can be on a different subject. Don't be shy. If you have any question in your mind, feel free to ask it. Yes.
Is there a difference between the practice of being mindful of your thoughts and emotions and everything kind of around, just sort of a general mindfulness, and resting in selfless awareness? Different practices, or are they the same thing?
So the question is, is there a difference between kind of being generally mindful, present to whatever one is doing, and resting in selfless awareness?
Yeah, here you use the two terms.
No, you're putting it on me now.
I was not clarification on this in my own practice.
So this is kind of a deep question. Because you're just talking, you know, again, we're talking about kind of spiritual life, Dharma life, as a developmental model, right? And in the beginning, when we are totally living in the world of dispersion and distraction, don't even know there's a present moment, don't even know there's a now, totally lost in our ideas and concepts about everything, right? It's good to what? Slow it down, let the sediment settle, let things clear up. That's called calming the mind, right? Mindfulness, being present, is certainly helpful to do that, right? As well, it's very enriching, right? All of a sudden, life becomes, because we're connecting with things, we're noticing things. Right, we're connected to the tea and the cup. We're actually having living experiences in life rather than always lost in thought. Okay, so that's a 180. Right, so in that case, the practice of mindfulness is bringing us into life and enriching life. Okay, and that's a wonderful step up into life. As Ricardo just reminded us, it's like coming into life in a, this is meditative way. I'm very present to it. I'm open and present. But mindfulness has its limits because, and this is taking Dharma the next step. So for those of you who want to interest in the next step, just pay attention. For those who are not interested, anyhow, but that kind of mindfulness is all occurring within the world of subject and object, which in Buddhism is the fundamental delusion, that we perceive ourselves as separate from. I from you, right? Humans from nature, from down, past from future. You know, we live in a world of opposites, separation. We're separate from people. People are separate from us. So in that practice of mindfulness, kind of regular mindfulness, it's all going on in the world as I am mindful that I am drinking tea. There's an I that's aware that he's drinking tea. So there's still that separation. There's still that I that thinks it's having an experience different than the tea. I, like, you know, I am looking at you. I am talking to you. You are listening to me. You can say that's very mindful. I am present that. But there's still that sense that there's an I here, a you there, and there's something going on, a third thing that's going on between us. So that's in a world of separation. The experience is cut up. It's being divided. It's called the world of relativity, the world of duality, the world of separation, the world of disconnection, the world of alienation, right? You know, lots of terms. The Buddha's experience in his enlightenment was that's not at all the way it is. That there's actually no separation at all. And that the truth is, there's no me talking to you. There's just this. And that in this moment, nothing is divided at all. There's no separation. There's just talking, and there's listening. And the idea that there's a me over here and a you over there are just thoughts that we create. So that is why we talk about this selfless awareness. Am I willing to even let go of the notion of me, which is just a notion? I mean, we say, I am talking to you. But what does that really mean? I mean, a mouth is moving. Words are coming out. But I don't know, have they? Or are they coming out? Do you see anything coming out? And whatever came out, where'd they go? You can't grab them. Is there anything really? There's sound. And the idea that there's an I that is speaking would posit that in addition to the mouth and the sound, there's also a somebody, an I, that's somehow doing all that, right? Wouldn't that mean that? I am talking. Now, so there would have to be an I, an entity, something inside, right? That's talking, right? For that to be true. But the words are just coming out spontaneously and naturally. There's no I making them, are they? Now, you might say, I'm listening, right? Are you making your ears listen? Does it just happen spontaneously and naturally? Do you have to do anything? No. What a miracle. We think we're in control, don't we? And yet it's all just happening, isn't it? I'm talking, you're listening. We use those words, forgive me, but it's in the world of words. Right? But it's just happening. So that's why that's real ease. There's no need to control anything. There's no need to force anything to happen. Things are just happening, right? The bell rings. We stop. The bell rings again, we uncross our legs. Bell rings again, we stand up. Bell rings again, we bow. I mean, does it get any simpler than that? The alarm clock goes off in the morning, what do? We wake up. We put our feet on the floor. We walk into the bathroom. we use the bathroom. I mean, what's easier than that? Go in the kitchen, you make your tea or coffee, right? Maybe have some breakfast. Any drama in any of that? No. Right? Go to work. Whatever you do at work is what you're going to do, right? Just moment by moment, just do it. I mean, what's so complicated about that? And yet we think our life is so complicated, right? So complex. Anyhow, we need to stop now. I thank you all for your questions.